In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with writer and musician Mark Saltzman. He was invited some years ago to visit a writing class at Central Juvenile Hall, which is home to some of the most violent teenage offenders in Los Angeles. And initially, he wanted to say no. However, he went anyway and was so surprised by what he found there that he decided to become a teacher himself and did spend a couple of years there teaching creative writing to some young men there, 15, 16, 17 years old. He says that his students reminded him of how important writing is, helping us to keep track of our lives as narrative journeys. And he also says that watching them struggle to write, even if they didn't feel like it, reminded him of how important persistence is. He writes all about this in the book True Notebooks. It's published by Knopf. It's out now in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. Just a little bit more about our guest. In addition to being an accomplished writer, he is also an accomplished musician. He is a cellist. He attended Yale, where he studied Chinese language and philosophy, and that eventually led him to travel to China, where he spent 2 years teaching English at Hunan Medical College. He also studied martial arts there, and his experiences were the inspiration for his first book, Iron and Silk, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. He also wrote the screenplay for and starred in the film version of Iron and Silk, which was shot entirely on location in China. His other books include a memoir, Lost in Place, Growing Up Absurd in Suburbia, The Laughing Sutra, The Soloist, and Lying Awake. His cello playing also appears on the soundtrack of several films, including an Academy Award-winning documentary, Breathing Lessons, The Life and Work of Mark O'Brien. He's good enough to have been invited by Yo-Yo Ma and Emmanuel Axe to join them as a guest cellist for a concert that they gave at Alice Tully Hall in New York, Valentine's Day. So he's interested in a lot of different things. We're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us this morning. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief. We ask that so we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody listening is welcome to call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Saltzman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
I gathered that, as I understand, this really started because you got involved in the project because you were working on a novel and it wasn't going terribly well. You were having some difficulty, and a part of it involved a character that you were working on that you were having a hard time with that happened to be someone who was a young offender. Someone apparently suggested to you, well, you know, I know a place that you can go and you can actually meet some, and maybe that would help you.
That's right. This friend of mine is a reporter for the LA Times, and I asked him if he could recommend any good books about juvenile delinquents that I could read for research, and he said, well, I can't think of any offhand, but I teach a group of boys at Juvenile Hall, all of whom are gang-involved and charged with very serious crimes. They could teach you more than any book, and I remember thinking, are you sure you can't recommend a good book? I just couldn't think of anything more depressing than the thought of visiting one of these facilities and then being in a room with a group of teenage thugs. I had been the smallest, most physically frail boy in my class from kindergarten all the way through finishing high school, and I was forever the victim of, you know, physically confident bullies, and the idea of, as an adult, putting myself back in a situation where they could humiliate me really didn't appeal. But I couldn't think of a way to say no to this invitation without seeming insensitive and uncaring. And so, you know, to save face, I said yes and went down to this place dreading it. And in fact, as we went into this place, I was so nervous that I thought I'd remembered reading somewhere that violent criminals don't like it if you look them in the eye. They take it as a challenge. Now, I remember now that that article was actually about dogs, but at the time, I thought it was about violent criminals. So I went in there determined not to look them in the eye. I didn't want to start anything, you know, any trouble. So I decided I would look at their hands. And as we sat in this little room, one by one, the boys walked in, and each of them was holding a sheet of notebook paper on which he'd written a poem or essay, and they were going to read it aloud to me. They wanted to see what I would think of it. And I looked at their hands, and their hands were shaking so hard from fear, they looked like cartoon characters. I'd never seen anything like it. And that helped me get over my own anxiety, because seeing that they were so nervous around me reminded me that regardless of the other things they'd done, they were still children. They were very insecure about what an adult would think. And then I listened to them read, and what they wrote just took me entirely by surprise.
Tell us a little bit more about these young men and what it, some of the kind of things that they did to result in their being there.
Well, in that class that I visited, all of the, I believe it was five boys in that writing class, they were all charged with murder. And then when I went on to teach my own class, I would say about 80 to 90% of the kids that went through my class in the 4 years I taught there were charged with either murder or attempted murder. So the unit where I taught in was where they held the high-risk offenders, the kids who are charged with the most serious crimes and who are considered the most incorrigible and who are being tried as adults. These are the ones that are considered unfit to be tried as juveniles because of the seriousness of their crimes, and so they're facing adult convictions and then being sent to adult prison to serve their sentences.
I don't know that I want to get to something quite so serious right up front, but I guess what this does is, reading a story like this, I think it invites you to think about how we think about what we do with people who commit crime. And the fact that, at least it seems to me, that as far as adult criminals are concerned, we've pretty much given up on the idea of rehabilitation. The only place we still hold on to that, and it seems that our grip is tenuous, is when we're talking about children. But that we still, you know, but then when you talk about children who have committed quote-unquote adult crimes, we just don't seem to know what to do with them. We seem to like to hold on to this idea that with somebody that young, there's the possibility that their life can change, and yet seems more and more we that idea is starting to slip away from us too.
It's true. I think it's not necessarily because we are callous people in society and we don't care about our kids. I think part of it just comes from a combination of fear and frustration. In the past, when there were more efforts at rehabilitation of serious juvenile offenders, the results of those rehabilitation programs were often disappointing, and I think that really frustrated people. If you set up programs, education programs for kids, then when they're released, within a year they get arrested again, it makes you wonder about the value of those education programs. And I think at this point now, we've become so frustrated that we have, in a sense, given up. Particularly with these kids that are accused of either chronic criminal activity or serious crimes, I think the feeling now is, hey, we tried in the past, nothing worked, so we've just got to keep them separated from society so they can't victimize anyone again. And that's it's a legitimate concern, and at this point, since we have not figured out the cure for crime, that there are many kids who the best we can do at this moment is to just make sure they can't commit more crimes. But I don't think that means we should give up on the idea that we may be close to figuring out better ways to deal with kids like this. I think that our commitment to try and offer something more to kids like this is a good one, and I think that I'm personally hopeful. I think that 100 years from now, we'll look back on our current lack of success with dealing with criminal kids the way we look back 100 years ago, how we dealt with mental illness. 100 years ago, we knew so little about it. We often lumped them all together, and we were so afraid of what this did to people's behavior. All we could think to do was to just keep them somehow separate, keep them from frightening or harming anyone else. Now, because we know so much more, we can have a much more humane and enlightened approach to it. I do think that will happen with our understanding of why kids like this do the things they do. But for us to get to that point, we have to believe that kids like this are worth saving. That's the tricky part. And we have to, in some sense, be convinced that they are part of our community and that there is enough humanity intact in them to be worth making that effort. And that was what my experience told me. I went into this just really not caring about juvenile criminals. They just seemed such a repulsive bunch. I really didn't want to think about them. But after working with them, getting to know them, I now feel that my desire to see kids like this get to see us find ways to reintegrate kids like this rather than lock them away for life, I think it's a worthwhile goal.
There are, I think, various places around the country different kinds of programs that are designed to put writers together with various groups of at-risk kids. And they happen in schools and in other kind of settings. And this is, you know, if you talk about sort of extreme population, here it would be one with the kind of kids that you're talking about, you had a chance to work with. How did this program, the one there at Central Juvenile Hall, how did that get started?
Well, it started, as so many of these interesting grassroots programs begin, with a couple of people who had this idea that it would work. It was, at that time, there were two. There was a nun, a Catholic nun who'd been chaplain at Juvenile Hall for many years, Sister Janet Harris, who had this feeling that one of the problems these kids face is that most of them, from the time they were tiny children, really never had much of a voice in within their family, within their school, their community, that they were mostly, in some sense, abandoned. And because they grew up with this very, very dim sense of self-worth, they act out negatively because it's the only way they can get attention. It's the only way they believe they can matter is if they get attention by being destructive, because whenever they would try to do something constructive, it tended to be ignored. And so Sister Janet felt that if she could bring writers together with these kids and convince them that in this kind of class they would not be judged by how well they spelled or whether they used punctuation correctly, and most of them, since they don't do that well, they're already sort of set for failure, but instead that they would be judged entirely on simply their willingness to tell a story honestly, to describe experiences from their own life in a way that other people could understand them. She felt this would be worthwhile, and at the same time, a writer, Karen Hunt, was looking for an opportunity. She'd been working with high school kids before, but she felt it would be interesting to try this with at-risk kids. And the two of them met and decided to start this little writing program at Central. And it started just with Karen, and then there was my friend Duane, the reporter from the LA Times, and then I was the third. And now it's grown. It's it's been 7 or 8 years now, and the program is all over Los Angeles now, not just in the juvenile detention facilities, but even at, you know, after-school at-risk programs that sometimes the judge will offer that as an alternative to being locked up if a kid is willing to participate in programs like this. So it's really spread from there.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Mark Saltzman, and we're talking about what you can find in his most recent book, True Notebooks, which is an account of some of his experience teaching creative writing class at Central Juvenile Home in Los Angeles, where some of the most violent teenage offenders are housed. The book is published by Knopf. It's out now if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, questions, comments are welcome. Anybody who wants to participate in the conversation can do that. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems we talked a little bit about how initially, when the suggestion was made to you that you could stop by this place and kind of see what these young men were like, and maybe that would help you in this book that you're working on. Initially, you were looking for reasons to say no, reasons that you could say no, and that then once you kind of got into it, there was still this interesting. You seem to be pulled in two ways in this sort of odd way. On the one hand, thinking that they would look at you and say, well, what has this guy got to say to me? Because your experience was so foreign from theirs. On the other hand, it seemed like maybe in part you were actually a little worried that some of them might become too bonded to you and might actually say, well, this is the, you know, I am looking for some sort of decent male presence in my life, and maybe this guy would be a pretty good candidate.
Well, certainly I became aware right away how hungry these kids are for an adult male mentor figure. These are all boys, so it would make sense that would be what they want. I did not teach the girls. Karen worked with them, so I can't speak for her experience, but for me it was obvious that every single one of these boys was simply starved for attention, for personal attention from an older male that they could in some sense bond to, and who that older male would give them challenges that they could then meet so that they could prove themselves. I think the one thing that really surprised me is how quickly they were willing to accept my values as the values they should struggled to achieve. I figured that a person like me going there, these kids would take one look at me and say, he has no street credibility. He's not like this, like us. He doesn't understand anything. I figured they would ignore me, you know, give me the tough guy treatment. And that was absolutely not true. Within two sessions of joining a class, each of those kids wanted so badly for me to for reassurance and approval from me that they were willing to say, okay, what do you want me to do? You want me to be a writer? I'll be a writer. And so it's true that I was concerned then that, well, what if these kids see me as a father figure and expect more from me than I'm able to give them? Well, the truth is that it never became a problem. I never solved that problem. There was nothing I did to prevent it. What simply happened, and Sister Janet, I think, described it best, she said that, Mark, these kids, all of them, are so used to adults disappearing from their lives, adults letting them down, adults not carrying through with promises, that they have actually very low expectations from adults. And so the fact that you come twice a week and you keep coming, that is surprising to them, and that's enough. You know, you don't worry that these kids are going to want more from you than you can offer, because they're probably, it's going to take them a whole year just to get used to the idea that you're not going to disappear, and that really proved true. And in all the years that I did the class, I never had one of the kids ask me to do something or give him something that was inappropriate, and I'm in touch with them still now that they're in adult prison. It's been it's been 4 or 5 years since they were all then sent on to adult prison. I still am in touch with them, and it still hasn't become a problem. So there's a sort of self-regulating thing going on there. It may help that they're locked up, in a sense. If they were in an after-school program, then that could be more of a concern, maybe. Maybe they would want to visit me at my home, things like that. But having them locked up, it really never became a problem for me.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that on our line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
First of all, I like two different things I'd like to say. One is a question, but the first is my compliments to you for doing this.
Thank you.
All of our politicians always, and this is neither a Republican or Democratic thing, have always said that our children are our future. The idea when you were discussing earlier why America mainstream is sort of shunning this group of children as dangerous to them is certainly realistic. I think it's obvious that we're doing that. Why we're doing it, I'm not sure. I think your reason is as good as any. But when you consider the value that each individual human being has and the investment that's made in that, almost an intrinsic investment, it seems sort of obvious that we have to do these kinds of things. Rehabilitation must be a focus. I mean, if not for the hardened criminal of age 60, certainly for children.
Yeah.
Number two, then, is there anything at all that people in this area, Champaign-Urbana, can do? You may have already mentioned it, and I didn't hear it, along these same lines. I am not an author per se. I write poetry. I'm an electrical engineer. I do lots of stuff. But this seems to me something that would be worthwhile becoming involved in.
Sure. Well, that's wonderful to hear. As I live in Los Angeles, so I'm not familiar with what sort of facilities you have in that area. But what I would say is that one thing we learned, all of us that were involved in this program, is that regardless of the volunteers like me who did this, some of us were published authors, some of us weren't. Some of us were people who our only writing experience was the letters we write home or the notes we write on our tax forms. And that almost didn't seem important. The kids, at least at this level, were not so much in need of specific writing advice or writing expertise. They were simply in need of an adult who was willing to pay attention to what they did, who was actually interested in hearing what they had to say. And I think what made this class so successful is that I was able, honestly, to go there, not out of a sense of obligation or, you know, dreading it but thinking it was a good thing to do, but I actually enjoyed it. It was the high point of my week, and the kids sensed that. And the reason that I enjoyed it so much is because I would go into the classroom and I would say, okay, today, write about the coldest you ever felt. I would just come up with topics like that would give them an opportunity to write about their own lives. And what would come back from these simple assignments, like one kid wrote in response to that question about the time when his father, who'd been in prison for 7 years, so the kid didn't know him at all, finally the father comes home after 7 years, and the boy has grown up fantasizing what it will be like to see his father. He's wanted to see his father so bad. And his father appears at the door and says, "Son, I missed you." And instead of feeling warmth and love, he felt as if the father had driven an ice pick into his heart. All the, you know, the anger, the resentment of being left alone, and of course his own guilt, feeling that he somehow as a child must have had something to do with it, it all came to the surface, and that was the coldest he ever felt at this moment that he thought would be the warmest. And that essay, it was only a paragraph long, was so moving, and to see all the other kids say, "That happened to me. I know just what you're talking about." That's a writer's dream, to be sitting around with people and have them share things like that, that we all immediately have an emotional connection to. So I think the great, the one thing you can bring to a program like this or to any activity like this is simply find something that you can honestly enjoy doing with the kids. And if you can do that, they sense it, and that's what makes it worthwhile for them. They feel then important. They have something to offer.
Well, thank you very much, and once again, thank you for continuing to do what you do.
Sure.
Well, thanks for the call. Yeah. Other people who are listening, certainly if you want to call in, have question, have comment, I want to talk with our guest, Mark Saltzman, that's certainly great. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think when you read the book and you read the excerpts from the students' writing that's there, you're really struck by these kinds of flashes of real insight that they seem to have about themselves. And I find myself thinking, boy, if you were a therapist, you'd feel lucky if you'd have, you know, in your career, you have very many breakthrough moments like that when someone says that. So that it makes me think about, well, first of all, that kind of insight maybe doesn't quite fit in the stereotypical vision we would have of a young offender like that. But it also makes me reflect on the kind of position that you were in being the teacher, and whether you either felt or sort of got pushed into this position of playing that kind of role.
Well, in a way, that's the beauty of it being a writing class. Because I'm not a trained therapist, and I really wouldn't know what the absolute best way to deal with, if a kid tells you a story like that, what is the best way to deal with it? I don't really know. But what I could do is I could listen with the other kids when he read this thing aloud, and at the end, I could say, "Man, I remember asking him right after he'd read it, I said that, you know, that is powerful writing." I said, "Can you tell me, was there ever a moment where you then did get to feel love for your father? Did you finally get over that?" And then he talked. He said, "Yeah, you know, within a few days, you know, that sort of ebbed, and that we had our good times. It's been rocky, but it's been up and down." So what we would do is we would talk about the piece, both as a piece of writing, but then also we would just let the conversation flow naturally. When you hear something like that, what do you want to know beyond that? And so there was no, I didn't really follow any strict rules about it. I just kind of let the kids determine what they wanted to talk about and how they did. And I just felt grateful to be there because, you know, there are moments where you're just with other people and they're talking about experiences that meant so much to them. And I don't know why, even if it's a tragic experience, there is something affirming about the value of life and of being human to hearing other people express deep human experiences. And I don't know, it meant that I didn't have to feign an interest in being there. Oh, speaking of, you know, the fellow who called was asking about how qualified you have to be, and my answer is that if you can find something you enjoy doing and you can do it with some of these kids, that's the best way. There was a Buddhist monk who came to Juvenile Hall to teach harmonica, because the harmonica was his hobby. And, you know, the kids loved that guy. It sounds absurd, and he, you know, wore the robes and everything, but he connected with the kids as deeply as I did because he enjoyed what he did, and they had a good time, and I think he served just as vital a function as someone like me.
Mm. Something that I think is interesting is the idea that you wouldn't want to dismiss the fact that these young men were violent, had committed violent crimes, and I'm sure that there is tension and stress and violence in the atmosphere of the place. And yet at the same time, it seems that for a lot of them, being in prison was in some odd way a better environment, maybe a safer environment than being on the street, because they there weren't the pressures to prove themselves quite that they found out on the street, and it could be in a way a little bit more relaxed kind of atmosphere. I don't know if I'm quite expressing that well enough, but I get that kind of feeling.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Several of the kids, in fact, most of them at one time or another, would say, although none of them liked being locked up, I don't think any person could ever enjoy being incarcerated, because you essentially lose all control over your own life. You're in an utterly humble position, in a sense, and I think any human being would find that painful. But almost every one of those kids found some way to say one of two things: either if I had not been locked up, I would have been dead within a month, because the cycle of violence had gotten so out of control that they probably would be dead, and then would have no chance to make anything with their life, because they wouldn't have a life. And then the other thing that many of them said is they felt that being incarcerated had made them mature, because grow in ways that they simply couldn't on the street, because, well, for one thing, they're locked up with people of other races, opposite gang affiliations. These are people who on the street they considered enemies. They were completely dehumanized, and they dehumanized each other in that way. And then to be thrust in this same difficult situation, naturally, and being, adolescents, it makes it all the stronger. Within a few weeks, if their unit, let's say that the KL unit is involved in a tug-of-war competition or a track and field competition with MN unit, the kids within KL unit might on the street have been shooting at each other, but as soon as they realize they're a team and they have to beat MN unit, suddenly they're cheering for each other. And I think for many of those kids, it did give them a little bit of insight into the meaninglessness of these tribes, these gangs that they've created. And not all, but I think some of them, it gave them... It doesn't mean that then you could then release them after that tug of war back to the street and they would never get involved in the gang. That's a separate problem. I think that once, if you take kids like this and you then release them simply back to the same environment that they knew from before, where they were not under strict supervision, where there just seemed to be nothing else to do than to hang out with the homeboys, you're going to see a very high rate of recidivism, of going right back to it, even if they've had moments of insight. But the moments of insight are there, and if they can be supported in a strong way over years and years, I think there is hope for saving kids like that.
Let me introduce again our guest. We're a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of focus. We're talking with Mark Saltzman. He is the author of a number of books, Iron and Silk, one that's an account of his 2 years in China, a memoir titled Lost in Place, and the novels The Laughing Sutra, The Soloist, and Lying Awake. And his most recent book, True Notebooks, which is published by Knopf, and it's an account of his experiences spending a couple of years teaching a creative writing class at Central Juvenile Hall, which is home to the most violent teenage offenders in Los Angeles. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Since these the young men there are pretty much waiting to go on to adult prison and have to know that they're looking at being in jail for a long time, or at least I would think to somebody of that age, if you said 10 years or 20 years or more than that, it would indeed seem like a long time. You wonder how it is they manage to maintain any kind of positive attitude, any kind of hopefulness, knowing that they're going to be there for a long time.
Well, another of many surprises for me was discovering through these kids how resilient and adaptable human beings are. These kids knew, most of them, that they were facing 25-year-to-life sentences, and they would talk about it, and they would say that they were worried about it, they were upset about it. But then, in a minute, you could change the subject. You could be talking about cars, or you could be talking about clothes, and they would be able to leave their concern, their fear, their anticipation aside for moments. Not all the time, but it could happen. They could still have cheerful moments. In our writing class, there were so many delightful moments, people telling touching or funny stories from their family life asking me about my life, curious, what is it like to be married? You know, are you worried that your wife might fall in love with another man? You know, all these simple life-type questions. They had curiosity about life outside themselves. And I remember talking with one of the guards in the unit about this, and he said, you know, Mark, I've got this theory that as awful as it is that kids this young are facing these terrible sentences, one thing that's a bit of a mercy is that none of these kids have paid a mortgage payment yet. And I said, what do you mean? He said, Mark, I didn't really grow up and didn't really understand the notion of the future until I started paying a mortgage. And so for a lot of these kids, they since they've been in and out of incarceration facilities, some of them since the age of 12, a lot of them don't yet know what 25 years means. They don't really know yet what they are missing, and it will sink in later, but for the time being, it protects them a little bit from the true brunt of anguish that most of us adults would feel if we found ourselves in that situation.
Is there any, I don't know if you have a copy of the book there with you, but I'm just wondering, because I would, you know, like to give people who are listening a little feeling for some of the writing of the students. I wonder, is there something you might like to read?
Sure. Just give me a moment, because
we should have tipped you before before we started the show, so that you would have that at hand, I guess.
That's fine. No, just give me a moment as I walk across. I'm now a stay-at-home dad, by the way. One of the experiences, one of the effects of this experience on me was that it made me want to have children of my own. So I now have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and I stay at home with her every day, and so we've got her set up with Play-Doh at the moment, but I've got my book. I can cross the room.
Well, that's good. You know, that's interesting, because I guess that was one of the things that I read in one of the things that I read of that, indeed, that what the experience had done for you was that it made you feel like you wanted to have children. So I guess that's optimistic. I guess you would say that has to be a good part of that, of what came out of the experience.
It was wonderful. It's I was reluctant. I was afraid to have kids because I didn't know. I just wondered if I would be a good father, if I would be able to split my attention between writing, which I obviously love, and then being able to, you know, play Chutes and Ladders and read Goodnight Moon 1,000 times over and over again. And I just couldn't see myself in the role naturally, and that scared me. But in meeting these kids, who are really the worst-case scenario, and people would say, oh, Mark, now you're never going to want to have kids, actually meeting these kids and finding that I could care about them. I could enjoy their company. I could care about their little victories and hope for them to experience maturity and all that stuff. It made me realize if I have my own kids, I'm really going to enjoy this. And so far, that's been true. I'm grateful. It's a debt I can never repay in a way, and it just shows you sometimes good things can come out of even the darkest places. Anyway, I found a little something, an example for you here. This is from a boy named Francisco, who is just terribly conflicted. You could see he wanted so badly to change his life. He was taking confirmation classes. He was getting deeply interested in religion, but he was also an impulsive kid. It was very hard for him to control his emotions, and that meant that he was constantly getting in trouble. If a kid would challenge him, you know, in a half a second, he'd be in a fist fight, and then he'd regret it. Oh, to see him anguishing over the stupidity of screwing up again. It was just so painful to watch. Well, anyway, one day he sat down in class, and he wrote something called Collision, and it goes like this. The angel is coming at full speed in one direction, while the devil comes in the other. The devil with his pitchfork, running at full speed, aiming to hit the angel in the chest, all of a sudden stops with the force of the angel's power. The devil tells the angel that he's going to kill him and that he's going to go to hell, but the angel responds, I'm with God, and the only place where I'm going to is his paradise. The devil then strikes him, sending him to eternal fire. The angel on his knees, weak, all of a sudden gets his energy back and strikes the devil with his wings and sends him to heaven. There they are, throwing blows, wrestling, doing what they can to win. All of a sudden, they're running full speed toward each other when they collide and become one. That one is me. So, like you were saying before, I think that a therapist would cherish a moment of insight like that. And that essay just described him so perfectly, because in his moments when he was contrite and remorseful, it was sincere. It wasn't feigned. But he couldn't hold on to it for very long. The angry part of him, the frustrated part, the part that just felt despair and hopelessness was also valid, was also real. And he couldn't simply eliminate one. He was stuck at this point where they were in conflict with each other, but he couldn't figure out how to integrate them. I remember one day I was crossing the yard, and one of the guards said, "Well, Mark, I understand you're having a really positive experience with the kids, and we're all glad about that, but you've got to remember, you see them at their best, whereas we see them at their worst. And so, you know, don't ever forget that." And it's a very good point. It is true. You don't want to fall into the error of thinking that because you see the kids in a certain moment where they rise to the occasion, they behave well, it doesn't mean you should then just send them home. Oh, they're okay. They won't kill again. But at the same time, I feel that some people would say that because the kids do behave badly in some circumstances, that means that what they showed in my class must somehow be an act. You know, they're just trying to impress you. But that's not the real kids. The real kids is what you see on the street. And my feeling is that both sides are real. Neither is particularly an act. They're both legitimate. I think the interesting question is, in the class that I ran, for example, I never had to play the role of authority figure. I never had to discipline a kid. I never had to ask a kid to leave the class. And I never had a fight break out in my class, which is remarkable for juvenile hall, because these are places where there are several fights a day breaking out. But in that class, the kids regulated their own behavior. They somehow held it together. They kept their tempers in check. They behaved like high school students. And so I think the interesting question is, what is it about those circumstances? What is it about that class, say, that made them rise to the occasion? And can we, if we can figure out what those circumstances were, can we spread them to other aspects of their lives? Can we bring those circumstances to other parts of their lives so that they gradually do gain a sense of the value of working within the rules of society?
We have someone else to talk with listening here in Champaign. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Were any of the kids that you worked with interested in your writing?
Oh, were any of them interested in my writing? They all expressed an interest in it. I would bring in copies of my books for them to read, and they would get so excited. I mean, the first thing they wanted to see is my name on it. They were just so... that just seemed kind of magical to them. And then to see the author photo, the idea that someone was actually the author of a book seemed very, very exciting. One of the problems with getting the opportunity to read the books is that the kids aren't allowed to have books in their cells. They're not allowed to have pencils or paper because all of these things theoretically can be used as weapons. So they could only read the book during our class, a few minutes at a time. And what would happen is, because these kids, a lot of them have very short attention spans, they would get, say, a third of the way through the book, and they would say how much they loved it, and then I'd, you know, they'd slow down. So I can't say that any of them actually finished any of my books, and maybe that says more about my books than about the kids, but they certainly had interest in them.
There was it's been years since I read Iron and Silk, but I recall a story that you recounted in there. You were either traveling on a bus or a train, and there were two men who seemed to have some designs on you in one way or another, and one of them wanted to know about your mother, and the other fellow said that was such a cruel question because you were obviously so far from your mother. I'm wondering if they read that story.
Yes, actually, one of the kids read that and enjoyed it so much he asked me to read it aloud to the rest of the class, and then it became a tradition about every 3 months or so when there would be some new kids in the class. They'd always ask me to read that story. I was on a train in China, seated, knee to knee in this crowded train across from two men, young men, who had just been released from prison for stabbing someone in a poker fight. And they were getting drunk. They were on their way home. And the drunker of the two was saying, "Oh, when we get to the train station, my mother's going to be waiting for me. My mother loves me. She used to come visit me every month. Oh, my mother this." And then the other guy slapped him with his hand across the chest and said, "Shut up." And the first guy says, "Why?" He says, "Because this guy here, his mother's on the other side of the world. He can't see her at all, and he doesn't need to know about your mother." And it was just one of those little tender moments from this tough, tough guy that took me by surprise. And the kids at Juvenile Hall loved this story. one reason being that motherhood is absolutely sacred in a place like juvenile hall. I suspect it's true in adult prison as well. But I remember one day I was invited to play my cello at juvenile hall in the chapel. So I did, and I was really worried it would not go over well because we had several hundred of these boy prisoners, you know, marched in, and right before my performance, they'd somehow convinced a hip-hop group with amplifiers and a girl with a, you know, bare belly just before me. And, of course, the boys loved the hip-hop band. They were so excited. They were stomping their feet and clapping. And then at exactly, you know, 2 p.m., that band gets whisked away, and out I come with my cello. And you could see these kids not happy about the replacement. So I come out and I say, well, you know, don't feel you have to understand this music. Just let it wash over you. Daydream. And I said, this first piece I'm going to play is called The Swan. It's by Camille Saint-Saëns. And whenever I play it, it makes me think of my mother. I said that innocently. It's true. I do think of my mother when I play it. I started playing the piece, and about halfway through, I heard this rustling sound. And I thought, uh-oh, you know, it's starting now. They're bored. They're just going to, it's going to be a riot, you know. And I look above the music, and what I see is that about half the boys have tears just streaming down their face, and they're not making any attempt to hide it. There's no sense of shame about it. And when I finished the piece, they gave me the ovation of a lifetime. I've never gotten such a response. So I then play a piece of Bach, and the response, not nearly as wild, you know, it's polite applause, but one kid in the back yells, play the piece about mothers again. And it turns out that's all he wanted me to do during my performance time, is just play that song over and over so that they could think of their mothers. It's really probably because for most of these kids, the mother may be the last person on earth who still has some unconditional love left for them. You know, they've alienated or frightened or terrorized so many people that there's nobody left except the mother. And you really see that on visiting day at juvenile hall, where you'll see really hundreds of mothers, often with babies on one arm and shopping bag under the other, waiting in line for their moment to visit their kid. And you just see very few men. It's just one of those sad realities. So for various reasons, mothers are sacred around juvenile hall. If you want to get kids to write, ask them to write about their moms.
Did they want to see evidence of your kung fu?
Yeah, well, they had, you know, they would hear that I had trained for many years and done it in China and all. But their question always was, have you ever been in a fight? And I would always say no, and they'd say, well, weren't you ever attacked? And I would tell them, well, actually, I was mugged once. And then they go, okay, so what happened? And I would tell them that I was so terrified during the experience. I was so shocked that I hallucinated that this was a positive experience. I not only gave the guy my wallet, but when he asked if I had anything else, I remembered I had a watch in my pocket. I said, oh, yeah, I've got this too. I cheerfully gave it to him. And after he went away, all of a sudden my knees started to shake, and I thought, kung fu. So I would tell them that. And at first they hated hearing this because, you know, they want their male mentors to be heroic. They want them to be tough. And they would hear me admit that I don't have a tough bone in my body, and they would just go, oh, no, oh, don't say it isn't so. But in time, I could see that they kind of enjoyed it. I think to them it was just such a shock that a man could admit to that kind of weakness and not be embarrassed by it. I mean, that's the thing, is they could tell that I'm not troubled by that. I think that's a, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm still alive. So that encounter with the robber went fine. I just think they thought that kind of fascinating.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left, and our guest is Mark Saltzman. He is an accomplished writer and musician. He's a cellist. Also has spent a lot of time studying martial arts, and his first book, Iron and Silk, was an account of the years he spent in China studying martial arts, and also initially he went there to teach English. He is also the author of two of the novels, The Laughing Sutra, The Soloist, and Lying Awake, and is the author of this new book that we've been talking about. It's titled True Notebooks, and it's published by Knopf, and it is an account of his experiences teaching creative writing at the Central Juvenile Hall in Los Angeles, a place where some of the most violent teen offenders are housed. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that must have been the staff people there that were supportive of this idea of having this writing class, but I'm really struck by this comment that was made to you by the guy, I guess, must have been the chief official, the person in charge of the place, who had some concerns about the fact that your class made the students feel special, and he said they come out of your classes feeling like something special, which makes it hard for them to leave your program and have to go back to our program, meaning, you know, back in the jail. And he said to you, remind them of where they are and who's in charge.
Yeah, we were having this meeting with the superintendent. We were requesting that he allow us, the several writing classes, to all meet together in one big gymnasium for a day so that all the kids could read aloud. And it was a risky thing to do, and you know, he was hesitant at first. But in the end, he did think it would be worth trying. And at the end, though, he said, I have a comment about your class I'd like to make. And so Duane and I were there, and we said, what is it? And he goes, well, your classes make the kids feel special. Now, we both felt that was a compliment. You know, we're smiling, and he said, now, you think that's a compliment, but it's not. It's a criticism, because when the kids come out of your class, they come out with this glow, feeling like, you know, they count, they matter. And then it's harder for them to go back to the sort of military-style program we have, where the idea is you as an individual are not important. Don't get, you know, you are part of a team, and don't ever forget it. And that's just an inherent contradiction. I do think that these kids desperately need structure, and so there is a lot to be said for a highly structured environment like the ones that you find in a juvenile hall or in prison. It provides stability. It provides, as you mentioned before, it's a safer environment, less chaotic than the one they're used to. But the downside to it, and the kids write very eloquently about this, is that it can take people who already feel that they're kind of worthless and make them feel even more worthless. And that can have negative, that can be a defeating thing. So when you have something like a writing class where the kids then begin to develop a sense of pride in what they do, and then to have to go right back to the program where they have to behave as if they individuality doesn't matter, it is sort of an inherent problem, and there isn't any solution to it. But I would say that I think that for the kids, it's better to have some moments where they feel they're not being judged and they feel that they can achieve something in the present, as opposed to just forever being evaluated by what they did in the past. I think everybody needs that, and so even though it may create some little difficulties for them in the prison environment, I think those difficulties might be worth sustaining.
Yeah. I guess I find myself coming back to, you know, maybe what is the central problem or the central challenge in being in something like this, that I imagine is trying to see and understand these young men in their totality. I think about going back to the comment where someone said to you, maybe it was a guard, he said, you know, you see these guys when they're at their best, well, we see them while they're at their worst. They are there for serious crimes. Some of them are there for having committed murder. And I think about, you know, a particular one young man that I think you came to really like, and who had shot some people in a theater, I think if I remember the story right, pretty much basically only because they mouthed off to him. And, you know, and your difficulty in trying to put together the part of this kid that you came to know that you really liked and saw some good in, with the idea that he did this incredibly stupid, cruel, thoughtless, idiotic, you know, whatever kind of word you want to put to it, shameful thing, and trying to put those two, trying to get in your head those two aspects of this one person together.
That's right. It is difficult. I think that the judge in that boy, Kevin, Kevin Jackson, the judge at his trial was quite eloquent during the sentencing hearing. He said, you know, this really is a tragedy. This boy had lost both his parents to a car crash when he was 9 years old, and from that point on was shuttled back and forth between distant family members who were really not prepared to be parents, to foster homes that did. It was just very sad, and so in a way, it's not surprising that a kid like that would end up having trouble at school. He had older brothers who were in gangs. I mean, it was kind of hard to imagine how a kid like that could survive at all. Anyway, he's done this terrible thing, and the judge said, "What's tragic about this is that all of the reports from all of the facilities where he's been held say that this is one of the nicest, most respectful, kids they've ever seen. I mean, the letters that came from the probation officers on this kid were so moving. And yet, as soon as he was released onto the street, he hung around with the same group of gang members and was capable of just these really stupid and thoughtless. His actions were the actions of someone who doesn't really understand that other people matter, that they are really real human beings, that they're not just almost characters in a video game. And he said, it's almost like a Jekyll and Hyde thing. It's mm-hmm. almost as if there are two people here that we're talking about. Go ahead.
I'm so sorry to interrupting you there when you're about to say a key thing. I'm at the point where we're really going to have to stop. And I'm really sorry. I wish we could continue, but we've just used the time. And I would certainly recommend to people who have been listening to us to look at the book, True Notebooks, published by Knopf, by our guest Mark Saltzman. You might also look at some of his others, particularly Iron and Silk. And I just want to say, Mark, thanks very much for spending some time and talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.